this talk is about moral relativism and its relationship to social and political life. First, I'm going to try to explain what relativism is. Second, I'm going to make some remarks concerning what people are relativists about. Third, I'll say a lot of things about relativism about morality, i.e. moral relativism, including why we don't need it. Finally, I'll wrap things up with a thought about why life is better without relativism. So this is the outline. Relativism, roughly speaking, is the idea that there isn't an absolute truth that's the same for everyone, but instead, something is true for one person, but not necessarily for another. So for example, someone might say, maybe it's true for you that sex should be reserved for marriage, but it's not true for me. Or for another example, someone might say, maybe it's true for you that there is no God, but for me, there is a God. Now right away, we have to be careful not to get tripped up by language. Sometimes in contemporary English, this is just expressions like these are just a way of expressing the fact that people don't agree. So someone might say something like this. For the Greek philosopher Plato, humans have a soul that survives death, but for the English philosopher Thomas Hobbes, there is no soul at all. And all that they would mean when they said such a thing is this. Plato believes that humans have a soul that survives death, and Hobbes believes that humans have no soul. Someone who said this would not actually be asserting that one thing was really true for Hobbes while another thing was really true for Plato. They could say this while believing that Plato was right, or that Hobbes was right. So right from the outset here, we need to make sure that we're clear that when we're talking about relativism and when we're using words, we have to make sure when we are really talking about relativism and when, alternatively, we're using words that sound like a discussion of relativism but are really just a way of talking about the boring old fact that sometimes people disagree. Now, actually, relativism rejects the idea that people disagree. If I say it's true for me that God exists, and you say it's true for you that God doesn't exist, we aren't disagreeing. It's similar to when I say that my favorite ice cream flavor is coffee, and you say that yours is chocolate. We aren't disagreeing. We're expressing our preferences. Likewise, if relativism is true, then when people say God exists for me, but not for you, they aren't discussing disagreement. I suppose maybe they're expressing the idea that people live in parallel realities. To tell you the truth, I suspect that the very notion of relativism makes no sense at all. By that, I don't mean that I think that relativism is false, but something stronger. I suspect that relativism is meaningless. But I don't want to get into that in this talk. I want to assume that relativism makes sense and then discuss a few other issues. What people are relativists about, why they think it's so important, especially moral relativism, and finally, why we can do just fine without relativism. Now, there are different types of relativism, and they can be distinguished by what the relativism is about. A super strong version of relativism says that every truth is relative. It's true for me that eating meat is okay, but it might not be true for you. It's true for me that the Bible is inspired, but it might not be true for you. It's true for me that 2 + 2 = 4, but it might not be true for you. Let's call this total relativism. Total relativism seems like a hopeless theory because it undermines itself. If total relativism is true, then everything that's true is true only in a relative way, including total relativism itself. But if total relativism is only relatively true, then it might not be true for me or for you. Let's leave total relativism behind. It's not an interesting theory, Much more interesting are various types of what we might call partial relativism. A partial relativist theory says that some truths are relative, but not all. So, for example, someone might say that political truths are relative, but mathematics and physics aren't. The first thing to say here is that partial relativism is not self-undermining. If you say that only some truths are relative, while others are absolute, then you can say that partial relativism itself is one of the absolute truths. Partial relativism doesn't apply to partial relativism itself, but that's okay, because partial relativism never said that all truths are relative. The second thing to say is that although partial relativism isn't self-undermining, that doesn't make it true. It might still be false, just for some other reason. The third thing to say is that there are many different possible kinds of partial relativism. For any partial realm of beliefs that you can think of, there could be a partial relativism applied to that realm. So someone could say that not all truths are relative, but that moral truth is always relative. Someone could say that not all truths are relative, but truths about art and literature are always relative. Someone could say that not all truths are relative, but truths about religion are always relative, and so on. Partial relativism that focuses on morality or ethics is extremely common in our society. This kind of relativism is called ethical relativism or moral relativism. Many people believe in moral relativism. Or, anyway, they think they do. I want to focus now on moral relativism for a while. Moral relativism says that although not all truths are relative, moral truths are. Claims about what is right or wrong are never absolutely true. They are only true for this or for that person. It may be true for you that lying is always wrong, but that doesn't mean it's true for me. Now, why would someone believe in moral relativism? One reason you sometimes hear is this: people don't agree about morality, so therefore morality is relative. Or here's another version of the same kind of thought: you can't convince other people about right and wrong, so therefore morality is relative. This is not a good reason for believing in moral relativism. Just because people can't agree on some truth doesn't mean that the truth isn't objective. It might be out there in all its absoluteness and glory without everyone being able to agree on it. Maybe it's out there but really hard to see. Maybe it's out there but some people are blind or stupid or whatever. Maybe it can be proved, but the proofs are really complicated, and most people can't follow them. Or maybe it can't be proved, but it's true anyway. In short, the fact of disagreement, or the fact that it's so difficult to convince others on moral questions, doesn't prove that there's no truth. It doesn't prove that there's nothing to agree, it doesn't prove that there's nothing to disagree about or to prove. There's a lot more to be said about whether moral relativism is true. To give a full account, we would have to start by thinking through important background questions, like what morality is in the first place. Then we would have to look at all the arguments people offer for thinking that moral claims are relative. Then we would have to ask how those arguments could be responded to, and what a good non-relative theory of morality would look like. To discuss all of that would take all night. In fact, it would take probably a number of one-semester courses, so I can't go into it all. Luckily, I think it's okay not to do so for our purposes here. That's because, as far as I can tell, almost nobody actually believes in moral relativism. They may say they do, but they don't. They don't, for example, think it's just relative whether torturing small children is wrong. I say this to their credit. If I said to them, well, it's true for me that torturing small children is acceptable, they would say, sorry, pal, it's not true for you. And if you think it is, then you are seriously wrong. Admittedly, there are a few people who really do believe in moral relativism. But probably they are all professional philosophers. That tells you something. I think that most people who seem to be relativists actually are something else. They are people who believe in moral non-relativism, but who use the language of moral relativism as a weapon for warding off certain evils. It will be easier to make clear what I mean by giving an example. Let's suppose you see three people in the street, Rocky, Nick, and Ella. Rocky is stoning Nick to death because Nick committed fornication. Ella says, hey, stop, Rocky. Stop. Stoning Nick is wrong. You shouldn't force your values on him. Don't you know that what's wrong for you might be right for him? Morality is relative, so you have no right to act in that way. Now, by the way, if you're having trouble keeping track of the names, Rocky is the one who is stoning someone. Nick is the guy who committed fornication. And Ella is the relativist. Okay, I don't think it would be too surprising to hear Ella say these things. But notice something weird. Ella is telling Rocky that it's wrong to stone Nick for committing fornication. Ella is obviously not a moral relativist. But then Ella goes on to affirm moral relativism in her attempt to get Rocky not to commit a moral wrong. Ella is using moral relativism in order to support a non-relative moral claim. She is using moral relativism in support of moral non-relativism. I said that this is weird. It's actually worse than weird. It's incoherent and self-undermining. Above, I said that moral relativism, whatever its flaws might be, isn't self-undermining in itself. And I'm not backing away from that here. I am saying, however, that it's self-undermining to use moral relativism in defense of moral absolutism. If your appeal to moral relativism is true, then you shouldn't be using it to support a non-relative moral claim. In fact, if Ella makes that mistake, Rocky can simply turn to her and say, is morality really relative? Well then, it's right for me to stone Nick. Now why would Ella act in this incoherent and self-undermining way? Well, for one thing, it's probably the case that Ella hasn't had a chance to attend enough talks sponsored by the Thomistic Institute. But I think there's something else going on here that deserves reflection. Ella is trying to prevent Rocky from wrongly interfering in Nick's life. Ella thinks either that Rocky shouldn't interfere with Nick's choices at all, or that he's interfering in the wrong way. For example, maybe Ella thinks that it would be okay for Rocky to ask Nick out for coffee and have a chat about sexual morality, but that bashing Nick's head in is taking things too far. Now perhaps you can begin to see the connection with social life and politics. When Ella makes use of the language of moral relativism, she does so to foster a certain political and social good, namely the preservation of a space within which people can make certain choices without fear of suffering violence. We can distinguish Ella's tool from Ella's goal. Ella's goal is to protect Nick from a certain kind of interference. Ella's tool is the affirmation of relativism. As we've seen, Ella's choice of tool undermines her goal, but we can ask whether a different tool might enable Ella to reach the same goal, namely the goal of protecting Nick from interference. One alternative tool is the distinction between making an ethical claim and forcing people to go along with an ethical claim. You can think that something is morally wrong without thinking it's right to force others to conform. For example, I think fornication is morally wrong, but I don't think I have any right to force people not to commit fornication. Likewise, you can think that something is morally obligatory without thinking it's right to force others to conform. I think that helping your parents when they are old is morally obligatory. But I don't think I have any right to force people to help their parents when they are old. Notice, by the way, that when we talk about forcing people, this can take two forms, non-political and political. Rocky is trying to force Nick to not act in a certain way, but he's not doing so politically. He would be forcing him politically if he tried to get Nick's behavior criminalized. This distinction between making a claim and enforcing a claim might sound obvious, and maybe in the abstract it is obvious, but in practice, people get confused. If you merely make a moral claim, people will sometimes say something like, "How dare you try to force your values on me?" So, for example, suppose someone says, "I think it's wrong to commit fornication." The person who says this might not be trying to force anything on anyone. But we all know it wouldn't be surprising if someone reacted by saying, "How dare you to force me to act in accordance with your values?" This isn't really a logical reaction, but it happens all the time. Avoiding it requires mental discipline. Perhaps you can guess already the way in which I think this is relevant to our topic here. Ella doesn't need to appeal to moral relativism in order to get Rocky to refrain from using force on Nick. She can hold on to moral absolutism, but then appeal to the principle that knowing that someone is acting wrongly doesn't give you a right to force them to act in a certain way. This is a much more logical strategy for her because it isn't self-undermining and incoherent. Likewise, shifting to the political level, Ella doesn't need to appeal to moral relativism in order to dissuade Rocky from criminalizing Nick's behavior. She can firmly embrace moral absolutism, including moral absolutism about fornication, but then say that although fornication is wrong, it's not the sort of thing that should be criminalized. The point in both cases is that she doesn't need relativism to get Rocky to not interfere with Nick's life. Okay, so that was the first alternative tool, the distinction between making a moral claim and forcing someone to go along with your claim. Once you see this difference, you don't need relativism anymore. Before going on to the second tool, however, I want to say something about the question of interference in other people's lives. I have granted that some interference is bad, but I don't want to give the impression that I think it's always wrong to interfere with others' decisions. First, I think it's fairly clear that at least sometimes it's acceptable and even obligatory to tell someone that they are going astray. I know that my life has been improved by other people calling me out on things, and I hope I would have the guts and the charity to do the same for others. Second, there really are times when we have to not just tell people that what they are doing is wrong, but block their actions. Sometimes we really have to intervene. In the silly example I gave earlier, Ella should not just argue with Rocky, she should try to grab his arms and make him stop. Third, there really are times when some immoral behavior needs to be criminalized. Stealing cars or shooting people should be against the law. Of course, what I've said here hasn't even begun to make clear when interference is good and what kind of interference is good. I just wanted to point out that I'm not trying to say that it's never warranted. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It's a difficult question. Okay, with that out of the way, let's turn to the second tool, the one that is nicely captured in the slogan, "Love the sinner and hate the sin." It's amazing how few people really understand this. People often think, quite rightly, that we should have a loving attitude towards everyone. And they notice that people who criticize others' moral behavior often do so in a harsh and unloving way. So, in order to get people to act in a loving way, they decide that it's bad to form negative judgments about people's behavior. If there's no such thing as sin, then you can't hate sinners, because there are no sinners to hate. In other words, they see moral relativism as a pathway to love. This might be behind Ella's rebuke of Rocky. She wants Rocky to love Nick, not hate him. And she sees that Rocky's mistreatment of Nick is rooted in the fact that Rocky doesn't like Nick's sins. So she tries to convince Rocky that there's no such thing as sin, because moral truth is relative. This will, she hopes, reorient Rocky's way of thinking so that he can love Nick. It's a strange but powerful fact that in this case, Ella has actually accepted the idea that we should hate sinners. Rocky thinks that we should hate sinners, and he believes in sin, so therefore he thinks we should hate Nick. Ella agrees with Rocky that we should hate sinners, if there are any. But she also thinks it's bad to hate people, so she decides that there aren't any sinners. But maybe Ella and Rocky are both wrong here. Maybe we shouldn't hate sinners. Maybe we should love sinners, but hate their sins. If Ella could learn to think like this, then she wouldn't have to appeal to moral relativism to defend Nick from Rocky. She could point out that although Nick's behavior needs improvement, we should still try to love and help him. Resorting to relativism isn't needed for this. I've just decided two ways of thinking that would allow Ella to protect Nick without resorting to moral relativism. Before leaving this topic, I'd like to bring up a possible objection to what I've been saying. Perhaps these alternate tools cannot be used in place of relativism as a way of protecting Nick from illegitimate interference, because perhaps even making and expressing a moral judgment is already a form of illegitimate interference. In other words, maybe the mere act of telling you that your actions are wrong is all by itself already an unacceptable interference in your life. If that were true, then the alternative tools would not be enough. My first response to this is to say that even if voicing moral disagreement was illegitimate interference, moral relativism isn't needed to block it. Instead, we could just have a moral rule that people should keep their moral judgments to themselves. In other words, we could say that morality is absolute, and it's okay for Rocky to disagree with Nick's behavior as long as he doesn't voice this opinion. So if merely voicing disagreement counts as unfair meddling in others' lives, the solution needn't be relativism. It could just be silence. My second response is to wonder about the psychological toughness of people who can't handle it when others disagree with them. Now, I do understand that some people have thin skin, and I don't think it's nice to be mean to people with thin skin. But even so, having really thin skin is a fault, not a virtue. I should be able to deal with it when you disagree with me. For example, I think it's okay to eat meat. Maybe you don't. Well, if you think that eating meat is wrong, you should be able to tell me that. Obviously, you have to choose the right time and place. Obviously, you have to do it in a polite fashion. Obviously, you should consider the possibility that it would be wiser to say nothing and let me figure it out on my own. Maybe you can tell that I'm so amazingly sensitive that I might have a nervous breakdown if you raise the issue. So you think that on balance, it's better not to. There are always particular considerations that need to be thought through. But it remains the case that, in principle, you have a right to voice your disagreement. It might make me uncomfortable. It might make me feel a bit pressured. But part of being a grown-up is dealing with the fact that people don't always agree with you. If I can't get through life without requiring everyone to be really nice to me all the time, then maybe I'm the one with the problem. Maybe, instead of resorting to moral relativism, I should spend a lot more time camping, or join the army, or whatever it takes to toughen me up. Above, I said that Ella's appeal to moral relativism was incoherent, inasmuch as she is appealing to it in order to make a point about morality. But now I want to discuss a more subtle version of Ella's approach, one that might not suffer from this flaw. maybe she isn't a total moral relativist. Maybe she's just a relativist about some moral issues. In particular, maybe her idea is this. Morality is absolute whenever your actions affect other people. But when your actions affect only yourself, then morality is relative. In other words, this theory holds that interpersonal morality is absolute, but personal morality is relative. So, for example, the obligation not to kill innocent people isn't one of those things that's true for some people, but not for others, because it concerns others. But, for example, the obligation not to get outrageously drunk or not to use pornography is one of those things that's true for some people, but not true for others, because it concerns only yourself. If my actions concern only me, then whether they are right or wrong is just true for me. This theory is not self-defeating in the way that Ella's first approach was. However, there are three considerations that make it seem pretty unimpressive. First, are there any good reasons for thinking that personal morality is relative while interpersonal morality is absolute? It's just not clear why we should believe this. If it's wrong to harm others, why isn't it also wrong to harm myself? Aren't I a person too? For example, binge drinking will definitely hurt me, and that's wrong. The fact that the person is me doesn't seem particularly relevant. Second, the distinction between personal and interpersonal morality isn't as clear as people sometimes wish to believe. If I harm myself, that will have spillover effects that affect other people as well. The idea that I can become lazy or greedy or hedonistic or outrageously drunk or whatever, that I can do these things without harming others, that's a kind of a naive thought. Third, I'm pretty sure that the real motive behind saying that personal morality is relative is the thought that actions that affect only me, if there really are any, are actions that other people shouldn't interfere with. Well, if interference is the issue, then we should return to the points that we were making before. In order to argue that interference is bad with regard to a certain realm of action, it's not necessary to say that moral relativism holds sway in that realm. One can just as easily stick to moral absolutism, but then add, first, that making a moral judgment doesn't mean forcing the other person to abide by it, and second, that we can hate the sin without hating the sinner. So, overall, even though there's no incoherence in the second version of Ella's position, the version that distinguishes personal from interpersonal morality, it's still, I think, not a very convincing position. Now, I want to take the analysis one step further. I have suggested that people adopt a relativistic stance or use relativistic language in order to block what they see as unjust interference. But there might be a deeper issue. There's a certain attitude towards life that I think is now quite common in our society. I call it feelings management. The idea of feelings management is that the task of living consists in managing your feelings so that on balance they're as positive as they can be. Now, I have chosen the word feelings on purpose to straddle both emotions and physical sensations. Feelings management is concerned with both, and figuring out how they are related is a crucial task for feelings management. For example, running a marathon is pretty unpleasant, but having run a marathon gives you a sense of accomplishment, bragging rights, and so on. For some people, the negative sensations of pain and fatigue involved in running the race just don't outweigh the positive emotions at the end. Well, for others, they do. And of course, you don't just have to balance physical sensations against emotions. You have to balance physical sensations against other physical sensations and emotions against other emotions. It's very complicated. But anyway, feelings management is about somehow juggling your physical sensations and your emotions in such a way that overall, you end up feeling as good as possible. I think that for a lot of people, trying to live a good life means being a good feelings manager. You try to avoid feeling physical pain, but perhaps a little physical pain is a price worth paying for the sake of being healthier. You enjoy your successes, but you try to avoid gloating about them, because when others feel bad, in comparison, you feel guilty. You try to avoid feeling guilty, but maybe a little guilt helps spur you on to accomplish something satisfying. The ultimate test, however, is how it makes you feel. Now notice, when I first gave the example of running a marathon, I noted that running a marathon seems to be a good choice for some feelings managers, but a bad choice for others. What works for you might not work for me. This really does seem to be a realm where relativity reigns. To generalize now, if life is all about feelings management, then anything that affects our feelings would seem to be a candidate for relativism. Now, surely moral judgments affect our feelings. So maybe feelings management is a further explanation of why people are attracted to moral relativism. If a certain moral ideal is too challenging, if I keep failing and feeling guilty, or if adhering to it means I'll have to miss out on pleasures I'm unwilling to give up, then I can just say that that moral ideal isn't true for me. Moral relativism is great for minimizing and even eliminating guilt. If, on the other hand, I like behaving in a certain way, then maybe I will decide that this way of acting is right for me. Once I've decided that, I will feel even better about that kind of action, and I will be more likely to persist in doing it. But notice, if the bottom line concern is how I feel, then there won't be any sense in thinking about morality as something objective or absolute, but only about how it works for me. If you'll forgive a brief side remark, I'd like to say that this also applies to forms of relativism that aren't moral relativism. Some people think, or anyway say, that the existence of God is relative, or that human nature is relative. No one would ever say that the existence of gravity was relative, or that the nature of copper was relative. So why be a relativist about God or human nature? The answer seems to be feelings management. Okay, back to the main line of thought. There are certain deep philosophical issues that are hard to argue about. Usually, the way you try to settle some dispute is by appealing to a deeper principle. For example, you can sometimes settle a dispute in engineering by appealing to some principle of physics or chemistry. But in philosophy, pretty much by definition, you are trying to get as close to the foundations as you can. At a certain point, you can't appeal to principles any deeper than the ones you are considering because you've already hit the foundation. This doesn't mean that there's no truth about the matter, and it doesn't mean that it can't be discovered, but it does mean that making progress is very difficult. I think we are now close to being at that sort of point. I don't think that living a good life is a matter of feelings management. I think it's about fully living out the kind of being that we are, a rational animal of a certain sort, a human sort. Just as there's a way for chickens to flourish or fail to flourish, so too there is a way for humans to flourish or fail to flourish. Morality, on this view, and this is a Thomistic kind of thing to say, it's a matter of flourishing, and wrong actions are those in which we fail to actualize ourselves in the right way. Those in which we fail to flourish, harming ourselves or others, or usually both. Anyway, if that's right, or anything close to right, then feelings management is just the wrong approach to life. The goal of life isn't to feel good, because we all know it's possible to feel pretty good while doing things that aren't good examples of being human. And we also know it's possible to train ourselves to feel good about bad things. Almost done. I have claimed that people appeal to relativism in order to promote social or legal tolerance. I have claimed that doing so is self-undermining, and I have claimed that it isn't necessary. I've also claimed, without much in the way of argument or even discussion, that relativism is false. Anyway, I would like to conclude by suggesting that relativism is actually harmful. Relativism is harmful because it means, in the end, that there's no right or wrong way to live your life. If there's no right or wrong way to live, then there's no such thing as success or failure. No such thing as a life lived well or a life lived badly. If that's so, then in a very important sense, life is meaningless. It might be enjoyable or unenjoyable, but that's not the same thing. So appeals to relativism aren't just bad arguments. They also contribute to the general feeling that life is pointless. That's not good. Isn't the incidence of misery, depression, and suicide high enough? I think we do better to drop all this relativism talk and relearn to talk about what is good, what is true, what is beautiful. Yes, people don't agree on what that is, and it might lead to conflict, but it's not as if we don't have conflict now. All this is, of course, only the beginning of a long investigation. Moral relativism can ultimately be overcome only through a positive view of what ethics is about, and also through getting the contents of that ethics right. You have to see that life isn't about feelings management, and you have to see that ethical principles involve not only judgments about what's right and wrong, but also about when it is and isn't legitimate to interfere in others' decisions. If we get all that straight, we'll no longer be tempted by relativism. Instead, we'll be drawn to the truth. Thank you.
I think we have time for a few questions or objections.
Thank you. Hi. It seemed like your definition of relativism was kind of that true for me is like relative to my whims or like relative to what I happen to want at a given moment. But could it be like relative to a person's conscience or to like science at the end of inquiry or something more noble and be a more sustainable philosophy?
I don't think it would make a difference in the end, but you're right that that was... I sort of rode over a bunch of distinctions. So another thing, there's a whole branch of relativism, various cultural forms of relativism, right, where something's relative to an entire culture. So for people within that culture, they can be wrong. It's just that if they belong to a different culture, it would be totally fine or whatever. Well, there's a lot of distinctions like that to be made in a much more detail. I still think the same kinds of points would apply. But you're right that it's more complicated. And some of them, I mean, I didn't mean to be quite so... You make me want to recheck the text. I didn't mean to make it sound quite so subject to people's just whims from moment to moment. And if I did, I should rewrite that or something. So yeah, I mean, any of these ones, if you understand relativism as being something that can just change from moment to moment, then that just seems much less noble. If you make it relative to a person's overall life approach or relative to a whole culture, then it's at least not changing every 5 seconds, and so it seems less stupid. Now, the other thing you said about, final science or whatever, that's a different kind of question. That doesn't sound like a relativist approach. I mean, there's, of course, questions about what one means by science and whether science, thus understood, has anything to say about morality. But just insofar as that means according to actual knowledge of the truth, that's not a relativist view anymore, it seems to me.
So you mentioned that the flourishing of the human animal is something we should base our ethical principles on. But this doesn't seem that different to me than saying that the flourishing of a certain culture or something like that. I mean, a species is still a unit which something can be relative to. If there were different species, for example, there might not be a different morality for that species.
Oh, good. Yeah, I actually think that's true. Morality for us is human morality. If there were rational beings that were very different from us, morality might be at least somewhat different from them. Now, there's a whole approach to ethics, which, I mean, the usual poster boy for this would be Kant, that tries to derive a lot of ethical principles just from practical reason alone, and to sort of abstract from the particularities of human nature. It's more complicated than actually, because Kant actually does talk about human nature in other works, right? But that is an approach to ethics. I think it does make sense to pay attention to human nature. Now, we don't know of any rational species that are different from us, so we don't know what to say. It's actually a really interesting question. You know, if they were just slightly different from us, like their ears were like one was higher and one was lower, it's hard to believe that that would really matter morally, you know. Although, you'd want to check, right? I mean, there might be something I'm missing here. But on the other hand, you know, if they reproduced in a totally different way, that would probably make a difference. Or if they couldn't be killed and then at the age of 60 they just dropped dead, that would change, you know, there would be certain stuff you could do. But you're right, it is, I mean, if I hadn't thought of calling it a kind of relative, but it is a kind of species relative approach to morality. I think that's right. Just as like, I mean, what counts as flourishing for a chicken is different for a... Well, no, I mean, people, I mean, it sounds funny, but like, if it matters to you whether the eggs that you buy came from a chicken that was in a pen, you know, 101% the size of the chicken, that shows that you think that there's something about flourishing for chickens, right?
Thanks for your talk. So where does God come into all of this, right? Like, if God doesn't exist, is there still, like, a good system that one can come up with to really say, like, this is what's true if there is no, like, lawmaker of the universe? Or are we then just left doing basically feelings management if there is no God?
Yes in one way and no in another. So I think that if morality is sort of a matter of figuring out what human flourishing is and then doing that, and abstracting from the question of whether human flourishing includes like worshiping God, because then that sort of like begs the question here, right? So let's just leave that out for a second. It ought to be possible, in principle, to figure out what human flourishing looks like, and then to pursue that, even if you don't know whether there's God or not. Now, if certain kinds of what you might call metaphysical arguments for God's existence work, there's a way in which I want to say the way they work is this. If there was no God, then nothing else would exist either. So if we're here and... Yeah, I mean, if we're here, then there must be a God, right? So if that's right, then on some theoretical level, you can't have morality without God. But I wouldn't say that it's automatically the case that people who don't believe in God just can't get anywhere with the notion of morality. I mean, it's sort of evident that they can, right, empirically. And I don't think they're just stealing ideas from theists. So people have a kind of sense of what human flourishing looks like. That's a kind of yes-no answer. Did that help at all? I mean, am I even addressing your concern?
So I guess what are we left to rely upon other than just, oh, this seems to feel good, right? Like
Oh, you're okay. So let me ask if this is a better way of...
What's the law?
Yeah, how do you tell...
Right.
Well, okay, we're putting it as a question of law is interesting. When we talk about moral law, there's an interesting question about whether we should do that if we're not willing to talk about a lawgiver. Okay, so I'll just make that little remark and then keep moving. Let me see if I can reframe your question without the word law, although maybe that distorts what you're asking. How do we know what's good for humans? So one way is by how does it make me feel. Another way is what God tells me. Is there some third way? Yeah, that's really... Is that sort
yeah.
of... Okay, good. I think of some area of life where you that you know a lot about. Could be clarinet playing, could be rugby, just something where you know a decent amount. You can tell better from worse in that realm. So there are realms where you don't have any idea, right? Like you're watching people play cricket, and you're like, I don't know, like who's good? Who's, I don't even know what they're doing, right? But then there's something else that you know really well, you can tell. So I want to say as just a starting point that if you have a lot of observation of human life, you start to pick up on stuff. You start to realize that certain ways of acting for individuals and for groups, they seem to be just doing a lot better. Now, what's behind... So I think in a way, and that's a work of reason. You're not just checking how it makes you feel, although it will make you feel certain ways. And that won't be totally irrelevant. But it's complicated because how you feel about it is, to some extent, a function of how you think about it. Right? So I do think it's more a task of reasoning than it is a task of checking your feelings. And it's based on experience. It helps to have a broader experience of life. It also helps to have, and this is a bit of luck, some exemplars of people who act really, really well. When you see that, it makes you realize, oh my gosh, I didn't know. Like, you could get up the same time every day. You could be, like, organized. Like, these can be life-changing experiences when you meet people who have their act together in a way that you didn't even realize was possible. So that's a first very hand-wavy argument. I mean, in theory, I mean, there's a whole different kind of answer I could have given, which would be to say that you sort of analyze human nature and figure out our fundamental inclinations and all this. This is sort of Thomist way of spelling this all out. But I feel like when you do it in the abstract like that, it sounds a little bit baggy. So I want to start with a sort of more intuitive, pre-philosophical idea that often enough we can tell, at least within limits.
All right, we can take one more.
Okay, sure.
You're sitting too close to the guy picking the
guys. Yeah, probably. So I had a question about the way you related to moral relativism as something, like this is the third and fourth point mainly, that nobody really believes in, except for some philosophers.
Something like that, yeah.
Yes.
Right.
I share your argument about the kind of incoherence mm-hmm. that Ella is expressing or that she's kind of part of.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure the depiction of moral relativism is right, and this is kind of linked to the question about death.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many moral relativists, like starting with Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, and Weber, who were actually suffering from moral relativism.
Yes.
So it's not something that they propose, but it is something that they fall
well,
back
good.
On because
yes.
they cannot agree with the way you kind of respond to it, which is a form of moralism.
Right.
Like an absolute moralism that is, you know, a form of applied ethics. It starts with specific principles, and they just see that history doesn't work that way. History is much more irrational. Is, as Weber would say, you know, a road of destroyed values. And they really kind of struggle with it
yes.
for their
yes.
entire life, and they try
yes.
to kind of deal with it, right?
Yeah.
And they come up with various solutions. But your solution is not part of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So then my question would be, how do you respond to them?
Good.
And isn't that more kind of a straw man that you're putting up in order to present morality as an applied ethics?
Well, it's. I think it's not a straw man in this sense. I wasn't my primary person that I'm thinking of here is not a few philosophers. Like, I'm not in dialogue with
yeah.
Nietzsche right now.
Right, right.
I'm in dialogue with all the millions of people we meet each day who say that they're relativists.
Yeah.
And my hunch is they just aren't, and I want to give them a little philosophical conceptual therapy so they can realize, oh, I guess I'm not a relativist, I don't need that, and move along.
Yeah.
But yeah, Sorry, I'm balking at the idea that Kierkegaard's a relativist. I'm not convinced, but that's like,
no,
that's not your point.
He was struggling with,
yeah.
For his, I mean, his exit strategy was Christianity, his own form of Christianity, but he was clear that faith was absurd. Right?
Yeah, oh, I get what you're saying. Well,
so,
anyway, it doesn't matter. Nietzsche's a nice example.
Weber,
I don't really know hardly anything about. I mean, I read, like, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism,
yeah,
35 years ago, which is not the book on this. So, but Nietzsche, I'm pretty interested in. Okay, so Nietzsche's a funny guy because on the one hand, he seems committed to something like relativism, right?
Yeah.
Nihilism or something. And it freaks him out. As he's, I think this is a very nice point that you're making. You know, I've portrayed a lot of people for whom relativism is a kind of part of their feelings management strategy. And you're saying, what about these other people who suffer from relativism?
Yeah.
Presumably they aren't doing it.
Well, you mentioned them at the end, right? I mean, the people that are depressed, that suffer from,
yeah,
you know...
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, that's right. That's true.
Yeah.
But I wasn't thinking of Nietzsche there. Yeah, but no, that's very nice. The funny thing about Nietzsche, for example, is I feel like on almost every page, he's trying to get us to do better. So there's something profoundly sort of conflicted about Nietzsche.
Absolutely.
He does think that we can do better. And so in a way, he's not a nihilist. Or he wants not to be a nihilist or something. So I mean, I feel like in a way there's a sort of philosophical judo move that you can do that goes something like this. Look, Nietzsche, you're trying to tell me to, like, you know, put down my bourgeois newspaper and get off my bourgeois behind and do something big to overcome relativism, blah, 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 or at least to get out of the way of the other person who's going to do it, more likely. But that, so, and I want to say to him, but that shows that actually you're sort of committed in a prior way to not being a relativist. The problem with that, I mean, I think as a bit of logical analysis, it seems all right, but it also has that feeling of the, of a sort of one of these philosophical moves. It's like a canned philosophical move. You just pull it out and do it. It doesn't address the sort of... it doesn't address where Nietzsche's coming from, somehow. And there's a reason why he feels conflicted about this sort of thing. So, how you would talk to someone who is him or herself suffering in this way, that's a different question.
Yeah.
That's a different question. And just telling them, look, look, I figured it out. You're right on the chalkboard. You see? You see your view is actually undermining itself. It's a performative self-contradiction. That's probably not going to do it for me.
Exactly.
There's something else.
Yes.
It's probably something that varies from person to person. You know?
All right. Well, thank you very much.